Welcome to episode 205 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today is going to be a little different from our regular episodes, as this is a special interview with one of the leading ski journalists in the UK, Frank Scoop Baldwin. Frank has been on the podcast before, but that was a short chat, and it was a long time ago now, back in episode 34. During Frank's career, he's edited about 20 magazines, but he's most well known as the editor and publisher of Skier and Snowboarder magazine, which he's been doing until recently for over 30 years. And that means he's seen more changes and knows more about the world of skiing than almost anyone else. So I'm delighted to welcome Frank back for a proper chat to find out more about his career and the history of ski magazines. Hi, Frank. How are you?
Hi. Very good, thanks.
Whereabouts are you today?
I'm in Kent at the moment, catching up with some friends.
Okay, that makes sense, because later on we'll discuss your career a little bit. And I know that's an area that you've lived and worked in a lot of your life. What about skiing? Have you been skiing this season, or when did you ski or snowboard last?
I skied last season in Les Arcs and La Plagne, which are obviously connected. But funnily enough, they were both separate weeks, so I didn't ski them both together. I did one and then the other.
You mentioned you didn't ski between the two. You know, these days you can connect and get a lift between Les Arcs and La Plagne, but I'm thinking when you first started that wasn't possible.
No, in fact, I was very lucky. I was invited out, so it shows how old I am now. I was invited out when they first thought of the idea of linking it, and I was taken to both the sites where the lift would go to. And so I saw it before it was joined, and then was invited back when it was eventually joined together some years later. Loads of political stuff to overcome when they did it, but they got there in the end.
Well, it's very impressive, and that's how they got Paradiski. And I think I talked about that in an episode just before Christmas. I can't remember what the number was, but I went to Les Arcs then and took that lift. Just to go back to yourself then, Frank, it would take us probably all day to cover all the different publications you've worked on and edited. But I mentioned that you're best known for Skier and Snowboarder magazine. Now, I think I'm right in saying that you recently sold the magazine. Is that right? Are you still involved in it at all?
Yeah, I have sold it, but I sold it to some people that I was already involved with. They were already working on the magazine on the sales side. They had their own portfolio of magazines already, so it's quite a nice fit. And they knew how it all worked. They're called Space Marketing. So there's effectively a new editor now, but I've stayed involved as a content consultant. So I'm still working on the magazine, but I don't own it and I don't edit it anymore.
But am I right in saying that until this winter then, you worked on that magazine or edited that magazine for 34 consecutive winters?
That's correct, yes. I owned it for 32 of those, because I was working on it for 2 years before I had the chance to buy it.
And that would make you the longest serving editor of any ski magazine in the UK.
There's journalists, very well-known journalists, that have been involved in skiing longer than I have. But I think I'm right. In fact, it was quite a wrench for me to give up the title of the longest continuous serving UK ski magazine editor.
We will talk later about your career before the industry, but I'm interested to know how that job first came about at Skier and Snowboarder magazine. Because you mentioned before you owned it, you were, you know, simply the editor. How did you find out about or get that job in the first place?
Well, there's a little bit of a story behind that. I won't give you the whole thing because we'd be here all day. But I always tell people that it was the 1987 hurricane that was directly responsible for me joining the ski business. I came to skiing fairly late. In fact, it was my wife who went on a school ski trip as a teacher. And she came back and said, "This would be your favourite holiday." And so we went with some friends to Les Arcs, funny enough, the first place I ever skied on snow. I was just hooked from day one. I loved it. I loved the mountains. Yeah. I loved being on the snow. I couldn't ski very well at all. I only had a couple of dry slope lessons and I was fairly hopeless, but I just absolutely loved it. So people began to know that I was interested in skiing. In fact, I went in with two friends and bought a ski apartment in Leyders Alp so we could go skiing more. So that's how much I was getting into it. But when the hurricane hit in 87, I was working on the local paper and in Sevenoaks, which was really badly hit by the hurricane. It sort of became an epicenter of the news for how the hurricane had affected the country. Sevenoaks became known as One Oak because six of its very famous Sevenoaks on the Vine in the middle of town had been blown down. My then editor, Bob Ogley, he then bought out some books on the hurricane that went to the number two in the Times bestsellers list. And he was in demand for giving tours and book signings and book talks and things like that. So effectively, I was doing his job as well as mine when he wasn't there. And this was going on for a while. And in the end, I sort of gave him an ultimatum and said either he came back and did his job or he had to leave and let me take over his role, as I was doing it anyway. He was very attached to the paper, couldn't make up his mind. So in the end, I resigned after somebody had put an ad on my desk, for the skier magazine it was then. They knew I loved skiing, so I applied for the job as editor of the Skier and got it.
Oh, sorry, they put the ad on your desk. They just came across it somewhere else and thought, you know what, this would be right for Frank.
Exactly. They'd seen it in another publication. I hadn't seen it. I would have missed it completely. And they just cut it out or ripped it out of a newspaper and left it on my desk.
I can't imagine there were many editor of Ski Magazine jobs available at the time. How did the interview or application process go for that?
Well, that's very interesting as well, because I've since found out from the publisher who then took me on, a guy called Leon Hopkins, that he was in accountancy magazines. He just sold those of them for quite a lot of money, started another publishing stable, of which the first magazine was The Skier. He advertised for the editor and said he was actually overwhelmed. He received over 500 applications. And the funny story was him and his wife apparently were out in the evenings. They were laying out all the piles of CVs and were saying, no, reject, that's a possible, that's a good possibility. Gradually worked the pile down to about 20 people, of which luckily I was one of them. But he told me later that one of the reasons they remembered mine was because somewhere in my covering letter I put, I love skiing so much, I once skied with a broken foot.
Is that true?
Yes, it is true, yeah.
How did that happen?
It was going to be the second time I'd ever been skiing. It was on on a school ski trip with my wife as a sort of a token member of staff to help out. I was playing badminton about 2 weeks before I was due to go, and I broke my foot just like that, and they put it in plaster. But I spoke to a doctor, and they said, well, if you still want to go on the trip, you probably shouldn't ski. At least you're able to walk around and go swimming and things like that. So I persuaded the local hospital to cut the cast off and went skiing, funnily enough, in Ladies Out, where I ended up buying the apartment. But after the first day, everybody came off the slope. They were all so excited and said what a fantastic day they'd had. And I looked totally miserable. But because we'd taken so many children, we'd also taken the school doctor. So just in case anybody had any problems, she saw me looking miserable and said, well, what's wrong? And I said, oh, no, really fed up. She said, well, I think, your foot's not that broken. She said, I reckon if you got it into a boot, that would act like a plaster cast, and then have a few glue vines and a couple of painkillers, and you'll be all right till lunchtime. I think she'd be struck off for that sort of advice now.
Yeah. So, that's not the sort of medical advice that you normally get, but therefore you got through the holiday, did you?
I did. I skied every day after that, and I actually did a couple of the ski tests, and one of the instructors sort of said, can I ask you, Frank, is there something wrong? Because when you go turn left, you get this big smile on your face, and when you turn right, there's this big grimace. And I said, well, actually, I've got a broken foot. He said, God, you must love skiing. So even he said it.
Well, there you go. And that earned you that job as editor of the Skier magazine. And sorry, that chap who founded the magazine, so was that a new magazine? Were you the first editor of it?
No, he bought a magazine off a couple of brothers called the Halifax Brothers. And I thought up till then that they'd started it, but they didn't. The Skier magazine has been going actually since the 1940s and was started by, I think the name's one of the Chilversteiners, because there's a family of Chilversteiners that got involved in the ski industry. I think one of the sons or nephews actually ran Rossignol Skis in the UK for a while, but it was his father or grandfather that actually started the Skier magazine just after the war, I think, or it might have even been just before the war.
I mean, that is very interesting. So I've just been up to Scotland, and regular listeners will have heard my episode about Scotland. And one of the things I was doing was looking into the history of skiing there, specifically in the era of Ben Laws. And the first Scottish ski hut there was built in 1932. And they ran the first slalom race in the UK and the first downhill race in the UK in 1934 and 1936. You're saying to me that magazine started in the 40s. So, around that era when you were starting to get people interested in skiing, and then all sorts of issues, evidently the war, the 50s, currency restrictions stopping people going overseas. But the time that you got this job was what we might call the halcyon days of the ski industry, certainly a period where it went through massive growth in the 1980s. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I became involved in 1989, and it had obviously been going as a glossy coffee table magazine earlier than that, about 10 years before that.
And how many issues were they publishing a year at that time then?
When I took over with Leon Hopkins, we started doing 9 a year. Before that, I think there was about 4 to 6 a year. To be honest, there was enough income around that time to keep 9 issues going. It was absolutely unbelievable.
And is that because we're talking about brands and tour operators and I guess destinations paying for advertising in the magazine?
It was more seen as a, I suppose, what you call an elitist sport in those days. I didn't see it like that, but that's how it was perceived. It was all things like the credit card companies and the car companies and the watch companies were all interested in reaching that market. And so we're putting their advertising in things like ski magazines.
The revenue is more about the advertising than actual magazine sales, because this would have been sold in shops, the magazine.
No, not at all. Honestly, I mean, I don't want to go too overboard about it, but in those days, I mean, we just never thought it was going to end. We were selling 25,000 copies through newsagents, and basically those 25,000 copies covered all the production costs. So anything we made in advertising, which was considerable, was all profit.
Fantastic. And not only were you selling 25,000 copies of The Skier, but there were several other ski magazines around at the same time, right?
There were, but as I say in modesty, they weren't getting anything like the numbers that we were getting. The nearest at that time was the Ski Club of Great Britain. That was because they're paid for copies. If you remember, you automatically got a copy of the magazine. So, but ours were sold, you know, in retail outlets. And so 25,000 people were buying them.
And I mean, that is interesting, because I think in the short chat that we had before, back in episode 34, I remember, you know, a time when you could walk into WH Smith. And in their magazines, there was a section for ski magazines, because there were that many publications and that kind of level of interest. So can you remember the names of any of the other competitors?
Ski Magazine, which we eventually bought. There was Ski Special, Skiing UK, Good Ski Guide.
You can see how the consumer could potentially get confused between the titles.
We were quite lucky, because nearly every other magazine was called Ski Something, whereas we were Skier, and we had quite a distinctive logo, which set us apart from the crowd. In fact, because our logo is so distinctive, it could be partly covered up, but you would still know it was the Skier magazine.
Well, we'll come back to the mag, and definitely, you know, I'd like to know more about that. But I wondered if I could take you back a little bit to your early career. I believe that your journalistic journey started in the days of Fleet Street back in the 70s.
Yes, I started in the Street of Shame. Yes, and it was very, very exciting.
And who were you working for then?
Well, I started off for the Fleet Street News Agency, which was sort of double-edged, because you either had to try and get stories before the national papers and then sell them the story, or they would employ you for a day or something to cover a job for them. I was lucky enough to make my name, because I started just as one of the first firemen strikes there were when they brought in the Green Goddesses. I think you have to be of a certain age to remember those. But basically, the forces were brought in to drive green fire engines because all the firemen were on strike. And I became known as the sort of strike correspondent.
To put it in context for, I guess, listeners from a different era, let's say, I mean, there was no internet. There was no email. There weren't even faxes back at that time. So how did you actually file those stories?
Well, for example, if I went to cover a fire, I would have to phone in the copy to what they call copy takers, who are all on the nationals. Most of them, nearly every paper wanted the story. In those days, there were about 7 dailies and 2 evenings. So you'd be reading the same story 9 times. So there was a copy taker at every different newspaper. Even when you went back to the office and wrote the story, if you had time and didn't do it over the phone, you still had to get either do it yourself or give it to someone to read to every one of the papers.
And, you know, you said, you know, you need to phone it in to the copy taker, but there's no mobile phones either. You're going to find yourself a fixed line or a phone box, presumably.
You had to find a phone box. Not only find a phone box, you had to find an unoccupied one and one that was working, because a lot of them didn't work in those days. And then you had, you know, some copy takers were better than others. Some could, you know, it was so fast, you could hear them bashing away in the background. Some of them, you know, were quite slow. And so it could take you about an hour to read the story over to every newspaper.
And, you know, on your screen just now, you've got your name up there as Scoop, and your nickname is Frank Scoop Baldwin. How did you get that nickname?
Well, it was my friends actually taking the mickey out of me. I mean, there's a famous book by Evelyn Waugh called Scoop, and it was basically after that. Some people unkindly said it was the way I played tennis. I had a scoop shot. It was to more my journalism, but also the name stuck because I've been very lucky that on the news side, well, even in skiing to a certain extent, news follows me about. I don't know why. I've just been very lucky to be attached by some major news stories.
Luck, obviously, in terms of stories, can play a part in a career. And you mentioned before that, you know, it was your wife who took you away on your first skiing holiday. Well, I think she went on a ski holiday and she said, this is the right holiday for you. What can you remember about that first holiday that you took?
Well, again, it seems so funny now, but it wasn't at the time. So we arrived in Les Arcs. It was towards the end of the season. And for the whole week, it was sunshine nearly every day and it snowed at night. So I thought skiing was always like that. Uh-huh. But on the first day, you know, I think this happens to a lot of people. I was with two beginners like myself, and there's about another four or five people that skied before. And they said, don't worry, we'll show you the ropes. We'll take you out on the mountain. Well, they pulled open the curtains on that first morning. Sun was beating down. There was about 6 foot of snow. And they said, we're off. See you later. We'll meet you there. And they all disappeared. I was left with these two other beginners, husband and wife. And we went out to in front of the Hotel de Golf in Les Arcs, which completely changed now. I mean, there's hardly any buildings there that you see there today. And there was this little bowl outside the Hotel de Golf. And so I'd been for two dry slope lessons. And at my two lessons, I had to show these other two how to ski, going down this tiny little slope in this bowl where we'd snowplow down, take our skis off, walk back to the top, snowplow down again. But gradually, by the end of the morning, we were sort of vaguely competent. And that's when the others came back for lunch and said, oh, well, we'll take you out now.
So for your first ever morning on snow, you were teaching two other people how to ski?
Yes.
That sounds, I don't know, maybe that's indicative of your career there, the way that you've been, you know, showing other people all about the ski industry.
Yeah.
You mentioned that your wife, you end up going on school ski trips with her, and you said before about how you went to Ladies Out with an injury, but you bought an apartment in Ladies Out. Was that just a coincidence? Was it like you went to Ladies Out and thought, right, okay, this looks like the place? Is a particular reason why you chose there?
Well, we went there as said on this school ski trip, and we liked it, and we looked at a couple of agencies while we were there, but still didn't really think seriously about it until we got back and we were all talking about, wouldn't it be nice to have a ski apartment? And as it was somewhere we knew, and I remember at that point my knowledge of ski resorts was very limited to Les Arcs and Ladies Out. We'd had such a good time in Ladies Out, we looked there, and three of us drove down there one summer, actually, not in the winter, and had a look at a couple of apartments and ended up buying one.
Right. Whereabouts in the town was it? I've been to Ladies Out a few times, going out there in a month, in fact.
As you come up from Mont de Lon, you enter Ladies Out, and then on the left, you pass a climbing sort of tower, and it was just there. A sort of funny story about when we sold it. We decided it was time to sell. Couldn't sell it for a while. And then a local family came in. One of the local families came in and offered us full price for it, which we took. And we were glad we got what we wanted for it. As a family, we decided we'd still like to still go back there and ski. And we used to go there every Christmas. And so we went back the next Christmas, and right outside the back door of our apartment was a new four-man chairlift that hadn't been there before. We didn't know about. But of course, this local family had inside information. So they knew that this chairlift was going to be built there. And it, of course, put the price of the apartment up.
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? Yeah, you do get a bit of local info that can help. Well, evidently you enjoyed, you know, skiing really early on. And, you know, you picked up that job at the skier, as it was. A couple of years later, you mentioned you ended up buying the magazine. How did that come about?
The magazine was a victim of its own success. The skier was so successful that the owner went out and bought another stable of trade magazines, which he put under the umbrella. They weren't doing as well as the skier, but he'd borrowed money against this new office building that we moved into. He was, I think, which we've since found out was a thing at the time, but nobody knew about. He was corporately mugged by his bank, who virtually said, well, you've got to pay this loan back now. We don't think your building's worth as much as your loan, so you've got to make up the difference. And he said, well, I don't want to do that. So they effectively pulled the plug, but the skier was still being very successful. And so I had a chance to buy it and did. One of the reasons they had trouble selling it, and again, I say this in modesty, is they had a couple of good offers for it, but the people said they'd only buy it if I went with it. And I said, well, why would I want to go with it when I want to buy it myself? There's lots of controversy around that. But fortunately, they eventually pulled out and left me free run.
Well, that gave you a strong bargaining position, given that you were a key part of the assets of the magazine. Yeah. So therefore, in the 32 years or so that you were managing or editing the magazine, seen a lot of changes in that time. We referred to it earlier as the Skier and Snowboarder magazine, which is best known as, but it was a Skier when you bought it. So when did you add the snowboarder side of things on?
It was while it was still owned by Leon, I introduced a snowboarder section in the magazine, because I think it's the first time, it's around 92. It might be the first time snowboarding had been in the Olympics, or it's getting close to that. I could see the growth in it, so I thought we should try to have some of that market. So yes, it was actually inside for a while, but then I decided it started becoming so big, I said we'd be better off adding the snowboarder title to it, which is what we did. Of course, the market got even bigger because there were a couple of dedicated snowboard magazines started. At the time, not trying to run down snowboarding, but at the time, we used to have funny arguments with the owners of the snowboard magazines, because they were saying, oh, we're going to be bigger than you in so many years' time, because the line's going up of how many people are going snowboarding. So it's interesting that although there's still snowboarding about, all those snowboard magazines have disappeared.
I mean, this is true. You can't necessarily assume that things are going to follow the trajectory that they're on. And I think evidently the development of kind of free ride skis, let's say, made a huge amount of a difference to that. You know, back then, when you talk about the 90s, there was this big divide between skiing and snowboarding, and that seems to have dissipated to a certain degree. There was another change that you introduced to the magazine. And that was, you talked before about how you were selling 25,000 copies, you know, back in the late 80s. But in latter years, there's been a switch to free distribution of the magazine. What led to that? Were you the first magazine to do that?
Yes, we were. It was about 20 years ago. It was at a time when I think it was WH Smith's had gotten a new MD, and he decided to start charging a lot of money for specialist magazines to appear on the shelves of WH Smith. Some of the other independents, you could still get into there either free or fairly reasonably, but WH Smith were charging a fortune, or wanted to charge a fortune. Now, to sell 25,000 copies, we had to print 50,000 copies. So you only got, I only sold half of them. That wasn't just in Smith's, that's across the whole range. But there was no real mechanism for getting back the 25,000 you hadn't sold. So they went to be pulped. You could get them back, but you had to pay to get your own magazines back. So it's all a bit of a mess. And at the time, there were some free newspapers starting. So I could see the way that the market was going. And so I just thought, well, I'd rather give away 50,000 magazines and double our readership and try and attract more advertising by having this higher circulation base. And it worked really well for us. And I'm glad we did it. But we did obviously lose that massive income from selling the magazine. But there again, we would have lost a lot of it anyway, having to pay Smiths to be on their shelves. We had lots of arguments with Smiths about it, because he said the reason people go into WH Smiths is because they have that whole range of magazines. That's one of their USPs. It wasn't just skiing. A lot of people poured their magazines off the shelves because Smiths just wanted too much money.
And you're saying that Smiths wanted to take a cut of each sale, or a flat rate, just to be allowed to distribute through WH Smith.
Yeah, they charge you to be on their shelves and take a cut of the cover price.
So I can understand that. And you mentioned, I mean, these days people are used to seeing free newspapers all over the place. Thinking about the Standard in London and Metro,
Metro, and of course there's City AM now. I mean, you can effectively, if you go up to London, you can get a Metro going up there, pick up a City AM when you arrive, and get the Evening Standard when you go home. I mean, in the old days, those free papers were awful, but they've improved quite a lot now. Going back to the magazines, funny enough, another one of the magazines around at the time was the Daily Mail ski magazine. And the company that produced it for them at the beginning, I can't remember the name of the publishing company, but they also produced Girl About Town. And that was really aimed at secretaries and people like that who were looking for new jobs. And that was incredibly successful. And that was given away free at underground stations. So you can see the model was there, and we just copied that, really.
And in the last few years, we've seen more ski magazines disappear. The Daily Mail that you mentioned, which kind of became morphed into the Telegraph Ski and Snowboard as well, that's gone now as they focused on different areas. Do you think it's still possible to make a profit in print media for snow sport?
I'm going to say yes, because I don't want to upset the people I've just sold the magazine to. No, but no, it is possible, but you have to keep adapting. I mean, what I did, and I think which helped us carry on being a success, was I could see that it was going to go online as well. So we were starting to beef up our website side. We were already doing an online version of the magazine, so you could send that to our database so people didn't necessarily have to pick it up. They could read it like a magazine online. But I think for things like skiing, people are most enthusiastic about reading about it when they're actually doing it. We came up with some great deals where the skier magazine was available in some like 250 ski resorts, in hire shops and in apartments and chalets. And it had a great bonus for us, which we hadn't anticipated, was that the people would read it, staying there for a week, but then they leave it for the next people. So you had this massive pass-on rate as well. So people like picking something like that and then putting it down, picking it up again, which you can't really do online. Well, you can do it, but it's not the same.
I understand. I think when I said making a profit in print media, I guess what I meant was for a paid-for magazine rather than something that's being given away free. And I think possibly there's an example of that in terms of Full Line magazine, which is kind of much more in a niche. And therefore, there's a certain clientele who are going to pay for that. And that's a model that can still work rather than the more generalist magazine. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've worked on a few similar magazines myself. So I would say, yes, it is possible.
And what do you think about the rise of other mediums then, such as bloggers or, dare I say it, podcasts?
The media landscape is changing. One of the reasons I decided to sell is not because I don't like it, is because if I was going to continue, I'd have to become more skilled in those areas to make them part of the skier. If I'd been a lot younger, I'd enjoyed that challenge. But I don't want to run myself down, but I'm approaching a sort of retirement time anyway, and I wouldn't want to spend the next, say, 3 or 4 years learning all that stuff or developing it to then not use it for anything.
Well, having our discussion in the green room before you came on, you've just been out in Lanzarote where you're playing tennis and walking for dinner, having come through a very rainy and wet winter in England, there is something quite appealing about that. I wouldn't knock it, but thinking about that environment that we have now, if someone is listening to this and they're thinking, I'd love to have a career in the ski industry as a journalist, what kind of advice would you offer them today?
I don't want to be negative about it, but I say to make money purely as a travel journalist is very, very difficult these days. You really have to have other strings to your bow. That can still be involved in travel. You might give talks or become an expert in a certain area and do it that way. Unfortunately, a lot of the national papers have cut down on their travel coverage, which I think is a mistake, because research continually shows that travel is a great audience builder. So it shouldn't be just how much advertising you can sell against it. It actually makes people want to read you. So there is still room for travel journalists, but I think the days when you could just make a living just out of that alone, unless you're very lucky, are long gone.
Well, based on what I get paid when I write articles for different magazines, there's no way I could live on it. My income is from doing digital marketing for people. Things like this, the podcast, is my hobby. But okay, that's really interesting. So I've got a couple of more general questions. That's really interesting to hear about your career and the magazine and the position and how it's changed. What about something kind of specific? Do you have any idea across your career how many resorts you've skied in?
I don't, actually. There's some other journalists I know who have skied an awful lot of resorts, but I tend to get invited back to the same ones a lot, which I don't mind at all, because we approached the way we covered places in a slightly different way, we think, to our competitors, where because of my news background, I always liked features with a good news story behind them. So I can go to the same resort several times, but I'll come out of it with a different story. We'll always look for a different angle every time. I'd say, well, for the last 34 years, I've skied on average 4 or 5 times a year.
It's a lot of ski trips. And, I know from the brief that you've given me for articles to write for Skier and Snowboarder, which I've enjoyed that opportunity across time, is that you're not looking for that kind of little travelogue-y type of thing. You're always looking for a story. Want it to be about a personality, that side of things. But you said you've gone back to quite a few resorts several times. Do you have an all-time favourite resort?
We always get asked that question, and it's incredibly difficult. I think there's two ways of looking at it. I've said if I could only ski in one more in my entire lifetime, I'd probably go back to Lasershow, obviously, because I had the apartment there and I know it really well. And I've got lots of friends there.
I know that across all of that time in the industry, you've also interviewed a lot of celebrities. Is there a favourite kind of a ski celebrity or celebrity that you've interviewed at any point?
I have, yes. And we introduced an occasional feature, which I really enjoyed, and it was called My Perfect Day. It wasn't aimed just at, you know, ski races and things like that. It was aimed at personalities and celebrities and people involved in the industry who ski. And the questions were, you know, if there was a perfect place you could ski or had a perfect day there, what would it consist of? You know, where would you stay? Who would you go with? Where do you stop for lunch? All those sort of things. And we've had some really big names like Roger Moore, Sir John Mills, and people like that. My favourite one was someone that people might not have heard of very much, but he was so interesting. His name is Chris Hadfield, and he's Canadian, and he was the commander of the International Space Station. And I came across him quite by accident, where I caught the end of some breakfast TV. They were interviewing about he just got back from the space station. The last throwaway line from him was, "I can't wait to get back on skis, but I can't go yet because in space you lose your bone density. And if I skied now and fell over, I'd break a leg. So I've got to wait a couple of months." So I thought this was really interesting. Got hold of his people, as they say, and he actually phoned me out of the blue and said, "This sounds really interesting. I'd love to do it. Can we do it over the phone?" I said, "Yeah, that's fine." And we had this long chat. And it turned out he's also got some record. He recorded his own version of Space Oddity with a guitar and got over 1 million hits online.
That does ring a bell. That's really interesting, that story though, Frank, because that almost is like summarizing the Scoop nickname.
Yeah.
There's a sniff of a story there, looked into it and ended up, you know, landing the interview.
Well, and also his perfect day was, because it quite mirrored mine, funnily enough, his perfect day was just getting up early, doing some nice runs with some friends, but then not massive après ski at the end. He said he'd much prefer to go back and just relax, have a few drinks with his mates afterwards and chat about the day. And it was much more mellow than, say, a full-on ski trip with après ski every day.
Definitely more my angle as well. Well, you've seen a lot of changes in your time in the industry. You've been through multiple recessions, I think, in that time.
Yeah.
I guess the rise of the low-cost airlines have been a, you know, big factor, that shift to digital. Now, what do you think is going to be next for the ski industry?
I think that in the current climate, some of the lower resorts are doomed. I'm sorry, I don't want to sound doom and gloom, but it's not as doom and gloom as a lot of people are making it out. I think everybody's got to work harder together to make sure that we have skiing in the future. And there will be ways to do that. But it's one of those things we can't put our heads in the sand. We've got to act now to make sure we still have skiing. It might be that they'll start building resorts in places like the Himalayas where the snow is going to stay longer or something like that. But I don't know. Despite what the doom mongers say, I think there's going to be skiing and snowboarding. It's going to be around for quite a bit longer.
Well, that is a really good positive note to finish on, Frank. You know, I've really enjoyed having our chat now, and I always enjoy it when we get to meet at the different, you know, industry events, but you never have enough time to be able to go through things in detail as we've been able to now. So I'd like to thank you for sharing all of your knowledge and all your experience and joining us today. I really appreciate it. Listener, I enjoy all feedback about the show. I'd like to know what you think, especially about our features. So please contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email at theskipodcast@gmail.com. If you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That helps other people find us. You can subscribe, so that will download every episode and you can watch them at your leisure. Or you can book your ski hire with Intersport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST or taking the link in the show notes. There are now 210 episodes to catch up with and 155 we'll listen to in the last week. There's loads to listen to in our back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to you. Now, you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. But for now, I'd like to thank Intersport for sponsoring the show and thank my special guest today, Frank Scoop Baldwin.
Thank you.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us. And until next time, goodbye.